The Mexican Jewish community is, I think, very particular. It's very insular, very well organized.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am with Shai Davidai.
My guest today describes herself as woman, Mexican, Jew, economist, activist, and advocate for causes. For those of you that are not watching this but listening in, I need to describe my guest before I introduce her. I want to remind people, it's not acceptable, it's not okay to describe how women look. We shouldn't be focusing on this, but my guest has a very unique look. Black, all black suit, business suit with hostages, yellow pin on the lapel, and neon pink short hair. So here I am with Adina Chelminski.
It's a pleasure to be here. Absolute pleasure.
And I have to say, before we start, Adina, I am so grateful for you being here. You live in Mexico City. We actually had lunch last week when I was visiting in Mexico City. And I told you, we can do this over Zoom. And you said, no, I want to come and have a conversation in person.
I think having a conversation one-on-one in person is much better than having a conversation over Zoom. I told you, and it sounds really corny, but you have been truly an inspiration over the past year. Your strength, your conviction, you're doing what you need to do without, I mean, it's become a fuss, but you're very focused on what you need to do. And it's truly been an inspiration for the past year. I wouldn't lose this opportunity for the world.
Thank you. I am so grateful. So I'm going to start this like I start every episode. And you're already prepared for this question,
I feel. Of course.
Adina Chelminski, what kind of a Jew are you?
Okay. I had a cousin who used to say that Judaism was a la carte religion.
A la carte religion.
Yeah. You could choose whatever part of it you wanted and you were still a Jew. So what this year has taught me is that I am an a la carte Jew. Because sometimes I'm an activist Jew. So sometimes I'm a scared Jew. Sometimes I'm a very modern Jew, as you can see in my hair. Ask my kids how modern I am whenever I try to mess into their lives. They say I'm a 18th century Jew. In some ways, I'm an old Jew because I've been Jewish all my life. In some ways, I'm a new Jew because I'm learning as I go a lot of new things about Judaism. So I think I'm an a la carte Jew. It depends on the day. And the beauty of Judaism is that it allows that leeway. You can be whatever Jew you want, depending on the circumstances, depending on your needs, sometimes I'm very close to the spiritual side, sometimes I'm not so close. And that's a wonder of Judaism.
That is a great answer, but I'm going to make it tougher on you now.
Okay.
If being Jewish is your the a la carte Jew, what kind of a Jew are you today? When you woke up this morning,
yes.
What kind of a Jew are you? And I guess maybe it's important to note for people that don't see. So you have a lot of tattoos.
Yes.
You have a tattoo of a Magen David on your left hand, the Star of David. You have a tattoo that says Chazak Ve'ematz.
Yes.
On your shoulder blade. You have a tattoo that says Hineni, here I am.
Yeah.
On your hand. What kind of a Jew are you today at this very moment?
Okay, today I am a very committed Jew. I know that talking to you is a huge, I don't know if it's a huge step, but it's a huge way to make my point of view known. To talk to you, I think I am a very committed Jew to the Jewish cause, which sounds really like we're fighting the Jewish cause, like we're going to play a football game. but I think I'm very committed to what Judaism or Jews around the world need to do right now in light of the circumstances we are facing. So today I woke up very committed.
Committed, Jew.
And the story of my tattoos, my kids have had tattoos for ages, and I had always been, why are you getting tattooed? It's not the Jewish thing to do. Your body. On October 10th, I said, I need a couple of tattoos. And wow. By the 17th, I was in the tattoo parlor having the Magen David and the Hineni done. And a couple of months later, I had the Chazak Bematz. And whenever they ask me, did you do it to remind yourself you're Jewish? And no, I did them in places that are very seen. I mean, you cannot hide your hands. So that it's very clear to everybody who meets me that I'm Jewish.
So you didn't do them to remind yourself you're Jewish. You did it to remind other people you're Jewish.
Exactly.
You know, it's interesting because I recently got my 18th tattoo. I called it my Chai tattoo, which is a tattoo in Hebrew. It says Emet, truth. And it's my first tattoo in Hebrew. I have many, many tattoos. And I was thinking, should I get a Hebrew tattoo? What if comes a time when we have to hide? Will I burn my hand? And I said, you know what? I am Jewish. I will always be Jewish. And if they come for me, you know, and they'll know that I'm Jewish because of my tattoo, so be it.
And the Hineni has like this special significance for me. Not because I'm very religious. I am not. But there are two times in the Torah where the word Hineni is used.
Hineni is here I am.
Here I am. No. But it's not only here I am as in po, as in no. I'm here. It's like I'm here in a committed, once again, that word, I'm here in a committed way. When God speaks to Abraham, for one of the times they speak, and when God speaks to Moses, telling him, I want you to guide the Jewish people, both times that were, believing in the Jewish history, both times that were very seminal to the Jewish story, the word Hineni appears. I'm here, I'm in complete presence, I'm committed to being here. So,
and I'll tell you even more, even if you don't believe in God, even if you don't believe in that this is the historical, but this is just a story that we've been telling for thousands of years, it doesn't matter. It's when the story focused on this, that means that there's something important in the story about this. And that's what we convey. But before we get to that, I want to talk about your different identities. And you have very intersecting, interesting identities. And I want to start with your identity as a Mexican Jew. You grew up, born and raised in Mexico City?
Born and raised in Mexico City.
Growing up, what was it like being Jewish in Mexico?
The Mexican Jewish community is, I think, very particular. You've been there, you've seen us. It's very small. It's when I was born, it was 50,000 people. Right now, it's 40,000 people, more or less. Most of us live in Mexico City. There are a few that live in different cities. It's very insular. It's very well organized. We have institutions for absolutely everything. It's very self-containing.
When you say absolutely everything, I want to make it clear to people that are not from Mexico, like what kind of institution. You have an Uber for Jews, Uber Magen David. You have organizations for addiction issues, for helping infertility, for helping Yad Lakala, women before they get married, for orphans. You have everything that, you know, if tragedy hits you, that you'll be there for them. You have, you know, 13 Jewish schools. Yeah.
You have entrepreneurship help. You have, from birth to death, mm-hmm. your whole life is covered in all senses. All of the organizations are pro bono by people. I mean, some people work there, but there are ideas that people have to make life better for Jews, making life better for Jews.
So most people volunteer in these organizations,
Most
which is
them,
a form of Jewish activism.
Yes, yes. The tzedakah institutions are very strong, very strong. And in some ways, it's very good because it's become a very insular community. We have a lot of relations, a lot of relationship with non-Jewish people, both institutionally and some people personally. It's a wonderful community. It really is a wonderful community.
And we'll talk about the bubble aspect of it. But before we get to the bubble, have you ever felt anti-Semitism growing up as a Jew in Mexico?
Okay. Right now, when all this anti-Semitism issue is like front and center in our lives, you try to, you know, hindsight, you try to think about things that have happened in your life. I never felt anti-Semitism. I felt that the non-Jewish world didn't understand what Jewish means. I mean, they knew I was Jewish. I mean, as you say, I have a lot of adjectives defining me, but for other people, whenever you're in a non-Jewish place, your first adjective is being Jewish. Yeah. I mean,
you're for the world, you're the Jew.
Yeah, first and foremost, you're a Jew. Even though I have pink hair, I am a pink haired Jew. I mean, that undeniably. The first time I experienced anti-Semitism was I went to a Jewish school all my life. I went to college, which is not Jewish. I studied economics. And I remember one of my classes was the economic history of Mexico. And the teacher, and you know, you just feel that something is going to happen before it happens. Mm. And the teacher is saying something about, the teacher is a very recognized economic historian in Mexico, really. And he starts saying about how that when the Spanish came to Mexico to discover Mexico, they stole all these things from the Aztecs and all the gold from the Aztecs. And right before it happens, I know I'm 18 years old, 19 years old. I know something is going to happen. And he says, just like when the Jews came to Mexico at the beginning of the 20th century.
Wait, so you know, most people listening to this do not know the history of the Jews in Mexico City. So this economics professor made a comparison of the Spanish colonizers, the
conquistadores.
Conquistadores to, you know, pillaging, exactly. Raping, you know, taking all the gold, taking all the minerals, bringing it back to Europe. And they were comparing that to mostly Jewish refugees that came from Syria, Lebanon, North Africa, and Europe to Mexico.
Yes. They came in dirt poor. And we did manage, or they did manage to make a life in Mexico, a very good life, through work. So he's making this comparison between like the the economic raping of the Aztecs and the Jewish refugees coming to Mexico.
Ooh.
And I stayed silent.
What happened in the classroom?
Everybody took it like, they took notes just like they were taking notes on how to add one and one. I mean, it was, and I stayed silent.
Why did you stay silent?
I don't know. Imagine how, I don't know if it's guilt, but how it marked me that I see, I mean, that was 30 years ago. 30 some years ago. I still remember that feeling. I mean, I was 18 years old or 19 years old, and there's this very respected teacher in the university saying that. This is way before all this anti-Semitism thing erupted after October 7th. And I remember, I still sometimes think about what I should have answered or what should I have said, or I should have stood up and left the room. It still haunts me. Mm.
30 years later.
Yeah. I mean, probably 32 years later. It still haunts me.
Visiting Mexico City, I had a lot of conversations like this where people have specific examples of things that they've experienced anti-Semitism in classrooms, at work, in the street, whatever it is, and that it haunts them. And it haunts them not that it happened, it haunts them that they didn't do or say anything.
Yeah. And right now, I think one of the parts, that story is very, I didn't know I was going to tell you that story, but right now, thinking about it in these few seconds, I think that's what attracts me so much to your activism. Because in some ways, for Jewish students, standing up to the establishment is hard. Because when you're 50 years old or when you're 40 years old, it's easier because your life is set up. You're stronger in some ways. When you're 18 years old or 19 years old, standing up to the establishment is very hard. And right now, it's what's going to be needed for Jewish students around the world. And that story, that anecdote that I just told you, reminds me of that impotence students sometimes feel and the need for guidance that they have right now.
I'll tell you even more. The irony of this is that as you and I, we are both, I think both you and I don't really identify like with this specific left, right, because we know that those labels are meaningless. But our values tend to be more on the liberal side. Our values tend to be more open. And part of the idea of liberal values is noticing power structures, noticing how people abuse their power, if it's in sexism, if it's racism, with homophobia, if it's anti-Semitism. And those are values that should be, that are part of the academic world, especially in the United States, but my understanding is also in Mexico. And yet, we who know about this power structure are afraid to speak up, whereas the professors who would speak up about any other power structure in this instance were actually using it to abuse their power.
In their favor.
In their favor, yeah. Exactly.
And I think it's very particular because I don't know if right now for professors in university, I know in the United States it would be acceptable to use that power dynamic in other, against in racist comments or in homophobic comments, but for some reason it's okay,
yeah,
to do it in anti-Semitic comments. However, having said that, that was paradise compared to what we are confronting now. It's become much more prevalent for Jewish students right now in university in Mexico to have issues with the, it's like subtle. The problem with these anti-Semitic comments is that they're so subtle that sometimes you wonder if you're right or wrong in having heard that, you know.
But let me push back. Why is that a problem? Would you rather it be open, blatant anti-Semitism? They talk about your nose and your horns and calling you bad names. Don't we want subtlety?
No, because in your face anti-Semitism, it's easier to distinguish and it's easier to combat. And whenever it never stays subtle. As we have seen in the past year, it never stays subtle. But this, when people are like, they thread a fine anti-Semitic line, it's harder to combat. Because I think, or at least it was for me when I was 19 years old. And maybe it's also harder now, because whenever there's this fine line where they're not really saying what they don't mean to say what they're saying, which is ironic, it's harder to perceive and it's harder to fight back, I think.
So And I want to get to the fighting part.
Yes.
I'm going to get with you to the fighting part. Before we get to the fighting part, I want to make it clear that fighting for Jewish civil rights is not just fighting against, but it's also fighting for. And we talked about the organization of the Jewish community. When I visited Mexico City, I left feeling a bit torn. And I'll tell you why. Because on the one hand, it's one of the strongest, most beautiful, most connected communities, Jewish communities that I've seen in the world, and I've been traveling a lot around the world. It made me want to stay. It made me want to become a part of the community. On the other hand, it feels a little bit like a very, very protected bubble. And I was trying to figure out, how do you balance the two things? Most of the people that I talked with, if they are under 18, they don't yet have non-Jewish friends because all of their life is in Jewish institutions. The first time they have Jewish friends is when they go to university. I was told that somewhere between 90 and 95% of the children go to Jewish schools. The Jewish children go to Jewish schools. How do you find this balance? Because you've been living in both worlds.
I think it's a balance that was very doable before October 7th. I do think that October 7th, I don't want to use the word changed, because changed is like it happened once and there was a change and now it's another world. October 7th is changing constantly for the past year, and I know in the future the relationship between the Jewish community and the non-Jewish community. And I think...
How is it changing it?
Because there is more anti-Semitism. There is the focus on Jewish people in Mexico is becoming more... There's more focus on what Jews are doing. There is... I mean, you can explain to your last breath that Jews is one thing and Israel is another thing, which I think it's the same. But people in Mexico, most people think that I have a personal phone connection with Netanyahu and can tell him what he needs to do and that he will listen.
Just to be clear, you don't?
Yes, but...
I thought every Jew has a phone call with a red phone with Netanyahu. Yeah,
but I only use it once a week. Okay. I mean, it's not an everyday
thing. And not on Shabbat.
No, yes. Not an everyday thing. The eye on the Jewish community is becoming more focused. Like before, we blended in. There's always been anti-Semitism everywhere in the world, but for most part, we've become part of Mexican life and a part of Mexican society, and nobody really minded. Most people never minded if you're in the social life and in the political life. We could manage both things, but I think October 7th is changing the dynamic, and it's making the Jewish community and people inside the Jewish community more noticeable. And I don't know where it's going to end. I don't know if it's going to be like, once the conflict in the war in Gaza is done, I don't think we're going to go back to normal or to whatever it was. I think there is a fundamental shift in Mexico and all across the diaspora in the way that Jewish communities and Jewish people are connecting with the non-Jews.
There has been a big shift, I think, everywhere outside in the diaspora, outside of Israel. Obviously, Israel is experiencing its own big shift.
Oh, of course.
But I want to talk about your shift. I have a sense, having talked with you several times, if we have been sitting here 2 years ago, very different Adina would be sitting in front of me.
I became a Jew on October 7th.
What happened? What happened on October? Where were you on October 7th?
I felt on the Friday night, I disconnected from my phone. I was really tired. I had a terrible day. So I went to sleep really, we had Shabbat, and I went to sleep really early. So I didn't know about what was happening until I woke up like at 4 in the morning, because my phone was flashing, you know, whenever you get a message, there's a light. It was turned, the sound was off, but I kept seeing that there were lights coming in and out of my phone. And I turned on my phone, I saw everything that was happening. So I literally was in bed when I found out. I've never felt such a sense of complete disarray. I know I still have no words to tell you what I felt those first few hours. I couldn't believe it, but I could believe it. But it was shocking. And it's really hard for me to talk about how shocking it was for me in my bed in Mexico. It sounds like very conceited when there was a tragedy going on in Israel. But I am not trying to compare the two tragedies, but it was unbelievable.
Have you been to Israel before October 7th?
Yes, a lot of times. I lived in Ashkelon, which is, for people who don't have the map in their minds, Ashkelon is right, it was right near the Gaza border. I lived there during the first Intifada. And I was in Israel a couple of months before October 7th. And since October 7th, I've been there three times.
So you saw everything that was happening. That's the external world.
Yes.
What's happening inside the internal world?
I mean, I felt like the weight of my ancestors coming into me saying, "You're Jewish." I had a grandfather who was born in Lithuania in the 20s and 30s. He came to Mexico in the late 20s. And he was a lot of his family died during the Holocaust. And he was always very wary about the outside world. He was very, very committed. He never bought anything that was German. I mean, nothing. He checked the labels on whatever he bought. I mean, nothing that was German. And during our whole lives, he told me and my brother that you had to be wary. You were Jewish. It was hard. You were different. People were always going to...
Did you listen to him?
No, we laughed on his back.
Why? Because, you laughed behind his back?
Because it was 1980s or the 1990s and... there was nothing going on, and the world, there was no social media, and we didn't know what was happening. And Israel was, even though we went there sometimes, it was like a million miles away. And in Mexico, things were, I mean, you're young, you have no idea what's going on. Yeah. We laughed behind his back. On October 9th, I called my brother and told him, "I'm very glad my grandfather died some years ago. This would have killed him." And he was right. And that sense, you know, people talk a lot about this Jewish DNA, that we're connected, like this Jewish chain where you're only a link, you know, the whole. And I felt that link being clicked. In my heart, in my brain, wherever you feel those things. I don't know if it's rational or irrational or emotional.
So what did you do?
I went to Israel. 20 days after October 7th, I traveled to Israel.
Tell me more. Where? Why? How?
I was in a complete state of shock and disarray. I mean, and my husband got invited to Israel by Birthright. Birthright organized the first Jewish mission to Israel on October. It was mid-October when they started planning. And they invited him. And I think he saw me in such a desperate state that he said, "Take my place. You go. You see. It's your place to go." So I took a plane and went to Israel. We were with I was with the Birthright people for 5 days, and I stayed with my family for a couple days more. And that was life changing. I mean, think about it. It was October. it wasn't even a month after October 7th. We went to the kibbutzim, we went to Zerot, we talked with a lot of people, we met the hostage families 20 days after or 30 days after the tragedy. And it was really eye-opening. I don't know if in a good way, but it was, I mean, we went to Kfar Aza when the Chevra Kadisha people were still cleaning.
If you close your eyes now, what is the one image or memory that comes from that early trip?
It's not what I saw. It's the smell, which sounds... But going into Kfar Aza, we had to go with a military escort because, I mean, that's the... It was... empty. No civilians were allowed. We went there with a military bus, and we went there with an escort, and we were all dressed in military gear. And I had seen the pictures, because by October 20-something, we had all seen the pictures. I mean, so in some sense, you have like a preview of what you're going to see. But you step down from the bus, and suddenly you get this smell, and you know what that smell is. You know it's like the smell of death. I mean, I don't know any other...
Can I ask you, what did it smell like?
Sour. I don't know. Sour. Like you're smelling something that shouldn't be smelled. I don't know, because I can imagine it's the smell of blood plus the smell of everything that was burnt and the smell of whatever human. And that part, if I close my eyes, I see black, I smell that. And the image there is an image I do see, is that we went to this house, well, this part of the Kfar Aza, and everything was burnt because houses were burned to the ground.
Just for people that may not know all the facts and everything, what had happened was the Hamas terrorists went door to door trying to kill as many people as possible. When they couldn't get into the bomb shelters, they would burn the houses and either wait for the people to come out to shoot them or burn them alive. Yes. This is why so many of the houses were burnt.
And there were two images. One is a house that was completely burned, and the only thing that survived was a soccer ball, a green soccer ball. Don't ask me why a green soccer ball, which it's like completely flammable.
You're Mexican and it's green.
Yeah.
It's, of course.
And the soccer. And in another house that was not burned, but the people inside were shot, in the outside table, in, you know, houses have like this porch, and there was this table that still had Coca-Cola bottles and beers in the table. Because the night before, the night before, which had been a Friday, I'm sure people had a Shabbat dinner in the porch, and they drank a beer and they had some soft drinks and whatever. And they probably said, we'll clean this up in the morning. And morning never came.
And then you had this experience, you came back to Mexico. What happened? What changed?
I started writing a lot and started to become very active in social media and in Mexican circles, writing about and explaining what had happened on October 7th. That's what I've done most of the 14 months that have happened since. And it's become an interesting experience, and I'm going to say interesting with
Quotation marks. With
quotation marks, because it has been interesting in every sense of the word. It's been very... I'm going to start with the bad and end with the good. It's been, I don't know how to say it, but a shit show of hate, as you know. Terrible. But I've also learned that there are a lot of non-Jewish people that really do want to learn. I don't know if the numbers are 50-50 or 90-10, or I don't know the percentages, I mean. But there are a lot of people that, non-Jewish, that do want to learn, that do want to know, that are, a lot of people are blinded by the social media frenzy. Yeah. But there are some people that really want to ask, that really want their questions answered, that have real, I don't know if concern is the word, but that have real need to understand what's going on. And I think that in this frenzy of all the hate and the social media madness, we are, or at least we can lose sight of this group of people that are really important to the Jewish cause. And let me say before, for everyone who doesn't know me, and you know this, the war is a tragedy. I mean, I am not minimizing everything that's going on for all sides. The war is a tragedy. But right now in Mexico, and I guess also in the United States, it's like there are two wars going on. The war in Israel and Gaza, where nobody has control. I mean, the Netanyahu phone call notwithstanding, nobody has control.
Yeah, we can't control. Jews in the United States, in Mexico, in Canada, in France, in Australia, they don't control this.
And also in Israel.
And in Israel, yes.
I mean, there is no control about what's going on. And there's this public conversation war in the diaspora, in the United States, in Canada, in Australia, in Mexico, in every place. There doesn't even have to be a Jewish community for this conversation to take place. That's being fought, and that's not as tragic, by no means, but it also has a lot of consequences. And that is a war where we can have some impact.
So tell me, how have you been fighting?
I've been very vocal in social media, very vocal in small groups, very vocal answering questions in to non-Jewish people.
What's the number one question that you get from non-Jewish people?
The number one question I get from non-Jewish people is, who is at fault? And in some ways, it sounds like a very easy question, but it's the hardest question to answer. But because we live in, I think part of what, I've never thought about that, but now that we're talking, I think one of the main problems about explaining the Israeli conflict to maybe even also to Jewish people, is what we're used to live in a world where there's good and there's evil. They're winners and they're losers. They're
oppressed and oppressor.
Yes, oppressed and oppressor. And everything is binary. It's like a soccer game. You're on this team or you're... And explaining the... And everything is... And this narrative in social media makes it very easy to see the world in a binary place. Because if you see a TikTok video that explains to you a situation in 30 seconds, well, it's super easy to say, wow, I understand. But the issue is so complex. The issue is so multifaceted, multidimensional, that people, who's at fault, is a very medullary question to the problem. It's very hard for people to understand the complexities involved, that except for some people whom I do reserve the title of absolute evil, most dynamics in the situation is very complicated.
So I completely agree with you. And I completely agree with the idea of we have to see all the nuance. One of a good friend of mine, an older Jewish woman, said that if she could change the world, she would make it so that everyone can have complicated views in their minds. This and that. X and Y, not this or this but. Yet, at the end of the day, when a non-Jewish Mexican asks you who's at fault, you need to give him an answer. What is the answer that you give him?
I talk about the complexities. I never point my finger. I mean, I think Hamas, what happened in October 7th, is absolutely inexcusable. I start with that. That it's situated in a very complex situation, undoubtedly. But I think that's like the hinge that separates the past from the present and the future. I think October 7th, even though it didn't happen in a vacuum, because I know a lot of people are going to say it didn't happen. No, it didn't happen in a vacuum.
Nothing happens in a vacuum.
No, nothing happened. I mean, it's not a lab.
No, but it's important to note this, because they always say it didn't happen in a vacuum when the victims are Jews.
Yeah, of course.
But they never say it didn't happen in a vacuum when the victims are anything else. Yeah. Nothing in the world happens in a vacuum.
No, it's like now there's this conversation about nothing justifies what's going on in Gaza. And nobody says, well, nothing justifies what happened on October 7th. I mean,
They even say resistance is justified.
Yeah. So it's become a battle. I think the social conversation has become who has the cutest, the word is not cute, but who has the wittiest arguments to fight this war? Because this social conversation war has become about having the wittiest arguments or speaking the loudest. Or as you've said, in a lot of things that you say, we're outnumbered. So it's become who yells the loudest, who has the most followers, who has the cutest slogans that rhyme, and that when the situation is tragic for everybody involved. And the side effects of what's going on in Gaza and in Israel have really permeated what's going on in the world. And as you said a couple of minutes ago, it's not only about the Jewish standing in the world, it's about the values, the Occidental values that have come into question.
I want to shift gear for a second, because I want to make sure we get to all of your identities. And I think, like me, you're 100% Jewish, not just in blood or religion, whatever, but in your identity. I feel like you're 100% Mexican, or 99%, 100%.
100%.
And you're 100% woman.
Yes.
And and many, many Mexican non-Jews will actually know you because of your voice speaking up for women and against sexism and for feminism. What is La Burra Arisca? And I hope I say it well. Is that La Burra Arisca?
You have a problem with the R's, which being Israeli, you shouldn't have. La Burra.
La Burra Arisca.
Yes. Okay. Fine.
Which, by the way, according to Google Translate, means the unruly donkey.
Yes.
Is that correct?
It's a very correct translation.
What is the unruly donkey?
The Unruly Donkey is a podcast I have with two co-hosts. That's a very big podcast in Mexico.
How big? Just so people, let's just say, a lot of times the joke about men that they compare size.
Yeah.
Your podcast is like 10 times bigger than this podcast for now.
It's 20 inches. No, I'm kidding. I don't know. Sometimes we get every episode has between 20,000 and 100,000 followers, which in Mexico is very big.
Yeah.
And we have a very big social media presence, and that it's one of the things I do, and it's very focused on the lives or the issues of women 35 and older, which is at least in Mexico, it's like this. People think that when women turn 40, they disappear from life. Mm-hmm. So that's our main focus. And we talk about politics and about sex and about health and about kids and about a huge range of issues.
How did you become a voice for women, for feminism in Mexico?
We got drunk. That's the truth.
What were you drinking?
Tequila. Me and two friends. As a matter of fact, you remember the restaurant where we had lunch?
Of course.
Okay. We went to that exact same restaurant. We were sitting in a table very close to where we sat. And we had one tequila too many, me and my two friends.
Just to be fair, I should say I was at a lunch with you and two people from Karen Kayemet who brought me to Mexico City. And for some reason, while I was in Mexico, everyone was trying to get me to drink mezcal all the time. And I said, not during the day because I have to speak.
Yes.
But you were drinking. You're getting drunk.
We go on a Friday. We have lunch. We're getting drunk. And Laura, my friend, says, this talk should be a podcast. And, you know, people who drink and text, I drink an Amazon. So
drink
I go,
and?
Amazon. So I go into Amazon. I buy three microphones,
yeah.
And I tell them, Monday we're taping. So I bought the worst microphones ever, as you can imagine. And we started taping in my house on an iPhone, the podcast. And that's how it started. And one thing led to another, and we uploaded to YouTube, and a producer saw it, and he said, you have a very good idea. Your techniques are nasty. Please let me help you. And he helped, and then one thing led to another, and that's how it became a podcast.
This is important because so many people, when even if they see this podcast, which by the way is so incredibly organized and executed and has nothing to do with me, it's all Achi Adamit from Adamit Productions and Abby Sophia, Gabe and Ben, the camera and editing, Ilana, the associate producer. They do everything. I just come and talk. But it's important for me for people to understand, speaking up, putting your voice out there, you don't need all of this.
No.
All you need is a microphone and an idea.
And let me take it a step further right now. You don't even need a microphone and an idea. I think people think you are an influencer if you have thousands of followers. I think the biggest source of influence or the biggest channel of influence people, Jews, everybody can have right now is on their small circles.
Interesting. Tell me more about that. Why in the small circles? Like, I would say, don't waste your time in like one-on-one. Go speak on media. Maybe 10,000 people will see it.
Yeah, but... And I think it connects well with what you say. The algorithm and the preconceived notions about the conflict and about Jewishness are so strong that I think doing it one-on-one, I mean, not one-on-one, but talking to your non-Jewish friends, talking to your colleagues, talking to your, I know you have a problem there, sorry, talking to your bosses, talking to...
Trust me, I want to talk with my colleagues.
Yes.
If they only reply to my emails or say hi when I'm there, that would be great. So. Yes.
I know.
But let's put me aside.
Yes. But for most people, I think you can have a huge impact. And you know why I'm telling you this? Because when we talk about Jewish activism or feminist activism or anti-LGBTQ hate activism, we think it's only for the influencers in social media. it's the job of every person alive to stand up, not only, even if you don't have a social media presence, to stand up in your life, in your social circles, in your small accounts, and stand up for what is right. And you can have more influence because the one-on-one and the conversation and the dialogue is very important.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. I don't know how many, I have like 100,000 followers or so on social media. I would rather have one follower, but 99,000 other people speaking up with one follower than all of this being in my hands or other people's hands.
However, what you're doing with 100,000 followers is you're creating 100,000 potential small influencers that can get your message or that can be inspired by you and start doing some sort of activism.
So now I want to, talking about your podcast, because I want to tie it to, again, like I said, your intersectional identities, which I just love. And I want to know one thing. You said about sitting in that classroom 30 years ago and you felt that something's coming. My mother-in-law calls this the OO feeling. And she talks about the OO feeling that women have when something doesn't look right, when there's going to be some danger from some, typically it's a man. I'm pretty sure that African Americans and Hispanics in the United States have that OO feeling the moment before someone says something racist, something xenophobic. And it all connects. And to me, it all connects with one video. Typically, a lot of times people show me like, you have to see this video. And I say, okay, send it to me, this video. And, you know, because most of the time people think the video is amazing and it's important, but I don't want to stand and watch a video. Last week, in the street in Mexico City, standing on the street, you forced me.
I know,
you
I'm
forced
so sorry.
Me, wait, but you forced me and two other, the guys from Cacao, Ricardo and David. And you said, you have to watch this video. I said, okay, send it to me. He's like, no, watch it now. And we ended up standing for 5 minutes watching this incredible, we couldn't stop, this incredible monologue where you talked on your podcast, which has nothing to do with Jewish issues, about October 7. And you talked about a term that really stuck with me, selective feminism. What is that?
After October 7th, and talking specifically about the sexual violence, not because there are not a huge amount of issues, but talking specifically about sexual violence, had become taboo in the feminist circles, at least in Mexico City.
You have become taboo.
No, the issue.
The issue.
Yeah, the issue. It was like, it doesn't matter if you're wearing a short skirt, nobody can harm you sexually.
Of course.
But if you're Israeli and you're at the Nova Festival, it's fair game. Mm. So a couple of months after October 7th, we did this program, which I forced into the Burrarisca programs about, we had the Israeli ambassador in Mexico.
Before you go on, what do you mean you forced? This is your show with your two other co-hosts?
Yeah, but my two other co-hosts are not Jewish. And it's become a subject. It's become a sore subject.
I see. So you had your ambassador, the Israeli ambassador to Mexico.
To talk specifically about the sexual violence Hamas had committed. And before the start of the program, I said I want to do a monologue, which is not usually in the program. And it became super viral. And I was talking about selective feminism because for 100 years, 50, at least for 50 years that I've known, the issue of sexual respect to women has been central, front and center in the feminist battle because it is an issue.
It's the most important issue.
Feeling safe wherever you are from being harmed sexually. I mean, it's front and center in the feminist cause. You cannot be harmed if you're wearing something sexy, if you're drunk, if you're you're nasty. You cannot be harmed sexually.
I think four words. Rape is never okay.
Yes.
Period.
And then in come the terrible news about October 7th, and people are women, feminist women, who have fought all their lives for this issue, suddenly have doubts. Suddenly want to put this in context. Some things.
Why?
Ironically, I'm going to say it depends on the context, which is bullshit. Sorry. I think there is an issue about antisemitism that is not named antisemitism that shines through the cracks. And I think that's one of the cracks where it's shown through. I don't know because I can never... I mean, there was the Boko Haram girls some years back. There's this huge issue with Iranian women in Iraq. Iranian women with Syrian women. And every time you stand up and you say, it is not okay. It is never okay. And it is never okay even for Palestinian women. It is never, never, never okay to use sexual violence as upside of war. Oh, I'm a soldier. I'm a resistance fighter. I can rape women. It is never okay. And people suddenly forgot. And in some senses, you could say that in the beginning, I said feminism sucks because of that. Right now, I can tell you it strengthens my conviction that feminism is right. Some feminists are not, but fighting for the respect of women.
All women.
All women. All women. The ones I like and the ones I don't. The ones I believe in and the ones I don't. It's medullary. And what happened on October 7th, the silence of the world, it can hurt us as Jewish women. It does hurt. But it took back the feminist movement 50 years. What happened on October 7th, we are going to see the result, the silence, not the issue, but the silence on sexual violence regarding October 7th. We are going to see the fruits, the rotten fruits in some years. Because when there is a problem in Iran and we have raped, I hope we don't, but when we have raped women somewhere else, it depends on the context. I mean, we set the feminist cause back 50 years or 40 years.
And you talked a lot about this in your monologue. What were the reactions to the monologue? Because I think that was something that your audience, while they were used to you and expected you to talk about women feminist issues, all of a sudden it was feminism and anti-Semitism.
And it's very in your face.
In your face.
It became very viral. Just keep in mind, it was in January of 2024. So the issues were not so... this whole issue with the social media craziness and anti-Semitism, it's growing. It has been growing throughout the month. So by January, the things were not so hot. I know that if I were to publish that monologue right now, people would be asking for my head because I said something wrong. So it was relatively well accepted. I mean, it became very viral. Inside the Jewish community, it was huge. I think it set two people to think about what I said, I'm fine.
And then talking about people wanting your head, what happened last week in the Guadalajara Book Festival?
We talk about this. The irony of it all is that you have this, like, we talked about it 2 days before. Okay, I'm going to start from the beginning. The Guadalajara Book Fair is the biggest Spanish-speaking book fair in the world. It is not a book fair in the sense of the word. It's a huge cultural event. Huge. I mean, huge. A million people attend. That's the size of the hugeness. It goes through 10 days in Guadalajara, which for people who don't know, it's Mexico's second or third largest city. So it's huge. I mean, a million people during 10 days.
Yeah.
There is always there's a book fair and there's like this part where there are hundreds of conferences. And 6 months ago, the organizers of the FIL said that Israel, the Mexican Jewish community, always has a stand selling books. We publish and about Israeli authors, about it has always had a booth. And like 6 months ago, 7 months ago, the FIL went to the Jewish community and said, we cannot guarantee your safety, which has become the de facto
silencing of Jews is we can't protect you, so don't speak up.
Yeah, we can't protect you, so no booth for you. Two friends, not Jewish, both of them, one of them Syrian, came to me and said, we cannot let this happen. Talking about the small amount of Jews, of non-Jews that really care about the situation. Let's do a panel. Let's have this conference where two Jews, two Arabs, talk not about the conflict, but about the conversation that the conflict is generating all across the world. So there are two people from either Arabs or with a Arab
descent.
Descent. There are two Jews, one very left, and me that I'm more center.
I would probably call the very left like an anti-Zionist progressive
Jew.
Yes, and you, for me, is like the ideal liberal.
Exactly. I was not going to say the word anti-Zionist, but very left leaning, and one person in the Arab side, more moderate, and another more leaning towards.
Yeah.
So the panel is perfect. It's like the perfect combination. 2 or 3 days before the conference, I get a call from from the organizer telling me, do you think there would be any security issues? And I said, no. He tells me, do you want a bodyguard? And I said, no way. I'm not going to go into any place with a bodyguard because it automatically sets you apart. So I call people I know who know about security in Mexico, and I tell them, should I get a bodyguard? And they say, what's the worst that could happen? Some yelling. I said, okay, I can handle yelling. I mean, I have three adult children. I went through their adolescence. What can they... Whomever has a adolescent children will know that you're used to everything. Okay. So we go to the conference and we are in the room waiting for the conference to happen, and these two women come in and tell the organizers, there's something strange. The lobby where the event is going to take place is full, but the auditorium is not. Well, maybe it will take time for them to come in. So we go into the conference, and whenever...
And to be clear, this is a conversation. And it's not just a conversation that's important to have. It's a conversation about the lack of conversation.
Exactly.
Right.
It's called Other Ways to Converse.
Right. Which is the entire thing that you've been doing all your life, trying to converse in dialogue, different
points
of view.
And ironically, three of the panelists are, you could say, very on the Palestinian side. I was the only panelist that could be more pro-Israeli, if I hate using that part because it again goes into the dynamics of it being pro or against, but let's simplify it and say it's a panel that's more pro the Palestinian side than pro the Israeli side. Just to...
Yeah.
The three other people are really smart. They're really, really smart people that anyone can benefit from listening to them. Anyone, anyone. So when the moderator starts talking, in comes an influx of the people who were in the lobby. Some wearing black shirts with a Palestinian Press logo on it. The first panelist, I mean, you see the influx of people. The first panelist, who's a Jew, who's very left, who was going to tell, yes, it's a genocide, whatever, says two words. He says, I am Jewish and I am from Arab descent. He says that sentence and all hell breaks loose.
And this is a Jewish panelist that they agree with, but we don't know yet because we don't even let them speak.
Exactly. And he said exactly one sentence. One sentence. I am, this for me is personal because I am both a Jew and I am both from Arab descent. And he says that, and all hell breaks loose. We have a guy starts yelling, genocide, genocide, genocide. The moderator says, please let them speak. This guy once again starts with the same sentence, I am a Jew of Arab descent. And all of the people that came into the conference, I mean, not all, but imagine, I felt there were millions, but all truth being told, I mean, there were 300 people in the auditorium, probably 200 people start coming to the podium. With Palestinian flags, yelling, with posters of my face, which they had made, with posters of the tweet, printed of tweets I had written on Twitter. And they start coming towards the podium where we're sitting. And this, I'm telling, whatever I'm telling you right now, I get from what the videos I've seen, because I don't...
You were shocked.
I don't remember. I see, I mean, tens of security guys stood in front of the panel. The moderator said, this panel is over, because there was absolutely no way of continuing. Someone comes up to me and says, please come to the back of the room. And I see that I stand up and then I sit back down because for some reason I thought a conversation was still possible. And after 10 seconds, 20 seconds, they come back to me and says, no, you really need to get out. So I go out of the room. The other three panelists try to talk with the mob and they're yelling at me, Adina, you're genocide, you're a genocidal, you did this specifically at me. I go into the back of the room. I'm kind of watching from the outside. And the other three panelists try talking to them. The security people take the other panelists out. My husband was in the audience. They took him out as well. We're in this back room. The other three panelists leave. And there was an issue of how to take me out of the back room and to another place.
A security issue.
Yeah. So in come these two bodyguards.
Wow. But you didn't want originally.
And as I go out, I see a human chain of people. I mean, it was 20 meters long. It felt like kilometers, 30 meters long from the safe room where I was to the place where they needed to take me. And there's this human chain of people you know, chained one to another.
Linked arms. Yeah.
Linked arms, yelling at me. And the only thing I remember is the bodyguards, like, I don't know, not carrying me, but like guiding me. And my husband behind me telling me, do not cry. Don't cry right now. Don't cry right now. Don't cry right now. Mm. And it must have taken like how long it takes you to walk 20 meters. I mean, seconds. I went into a room.
Did you cry?
Of course I cried. Of course I cried. And of course I cried. I cried when I was walking.
Why were you crying?
I was scared. Scared. When I told you about, when you asked me what kind of Jew I was, and I said, sometimes I'm the Jew with, I'm not the Jew with trembling knees. Sometimes your knees do tremble. Sometimes I was scared. I had never seen such an amount of hate, which once again, I want to put into context. I know this whole issue is about hate and there's worse. I mean, people yelling at you, it's not exactly.
You don't need to explain. You don't need to explain.
I'd never seen that amount of hate. I was scared, really. And when I got into a room, the first thing I thought, I'm going to tell you why I got so scared right now. Are you going to charge me like the psychiatrist fee?
No, I'm going to charge you the friend fee.
I had exactly the same feeling I had from that moment at the university. Right now I'm connecting the dots. I had that exact same feeling because I didn't say anything. I mean, they almost carried me back to the exact feeling of being of important, absolute
impotence
and keeping quiet. I mean, here it was an issue of security. And I cried.
Totally fine.
And the next day, after I cried, I needed to have a couple of beers. That's another story. But the next day when I woke up, the only thing I was mad as hell. This happened on a Thursday. On Friday, I woke up and I was furious. And the only thing I thought was, I can handle it because worst comes to worst, I have a bodyguard. I mean, but what about the rest of the people, the rest of the Jews?
So I want to ask you, because when I was in Mexico City, everyone was asking me, especially the young Jewish people, what should we do? How should we act? And I tell them, I am not from here. I don't know all the nuances. I can't come and tell you what I can tell you what to do in New York City and Los Angeles and San Francisco and Toronto and Montreal. And I traveled to these communities and organized. You are probably the most visible, if maybe the one of only few Jewish Mexican people that are speaking up, that are activists. What advice would you have for young Jewish Mexican people?
When you left Mexico, you made this great YouTube Instagram video about balancing between what's worked really good for the Jewish community for tens of years, which is working behind the scenes and balancing it with standing up and speaking out, which I thought was a great advice. And you said, I don't know what the balance is, but it's these two parts. And I've been thinking about that, and I've been thinking about that with another great quote. When they asked Mark Twain how he went bankrupt, he said, slowly, then suddenly. Which I think is what happened in Mexico. Or at least the events that led up to the FIL event. Just to put it in context, the FIL has been hosting hundreds of conferences every year for 35 years. This is the first time this has happened.
Cancelled event, yeah.
They've had talks about Mexican politics, about drug dealers, about any subject.
The only thing they will not talk about is
the only thing people
Israel.
Will protest against in a way that cancels a conference is Israel. And in some senses, it's not Israel also. It's a Jewish. I mean, there is, I don't know how to differentiate in the public sphere.
So anti-Semitism is happening slowly, 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 and then suddenly.
Yeah.
What should a young Jewish Mexican person who wants to do something do?
I think we should educate our Jewish youth better. Jewish education. Yesterday I was talking with Ilana about this, who's the associate producer. And in Mexico, there is a sense, and I'm going to say it out loud. I don't know how people are going to take this. But in Mexico, and maybe also in the United States, I don't know, there is this sense in education that your Jewish relationship to Israel has to do with thinking or saying Israel is perfect, you know, which is not. No country is perfect. No issue is perfect. No conflict is, nobody's perfect. And I think, first of all, we need to start having the talk about, this is the year I've criticized Israel the most and the year I felt more Jewish and more connected to Israel in my life. So perfection, your Jewish soul or your Zionist soul doesn't have to depend on Israel being perfect. And we have to educate people on the complexities of the stories. Because then when you go out into the world and people tell you something you don't know how to answer, then you're lost and you've lost the argument. So we need to focus on a stronger, complex education, number one. We need to strengthen the insides of the Jewish community. Let me explain to you. It's a great community. It's wonderful. There are a lot of very banal differences.
I know
if you're Ashkenazi, if you're Sephardic, if you're gay, if you're straight, if you're religious, if you're secular, if you're pro BB, if you're and everybody. So we need to say enough. We're Jews. We don't have to like each other. We don't have to like each other's views. But if in the eyes of the, it's like this joke where they say that a religious Jew and a secular Jew go into a bar and the bartender says, I don't serve Jews. In the eyes of everybody, we're Jewish. We have to strengthen that great Jewish community we have. Just take it to the 21st century, let's say. I mean,
which is what? Give me actual tips. I want to be a Jewish young activist in Mexico.
Stop focusing on someone's gay, someone's not gay, pro-abortion, anti-abortion. Stop focusing. Everybody's Jewish. You talk to everybody. You respect everybody in the Jewish community, number one. Number two, you learn about the conflict. It's easier to fight disinformation with information.
Right.
And 2A, let's say subtext of point two, is there is no single story. Point four, which I, or three, or whatever next number comes, I think a lot of young people in this frenzy of social media and this hurt and desperation have lost sense of the forms. Form, they've become very aggressive. They've become very in your face, saying bad words or insulting people, which I know other people do it. It's not the way. It's not the, nobody's going to have a dialogue with you if you call them a bad name. Nobody, nobody, never in any issue. So we need to focus on form, which
I have to learn too, by the way.
No,
which is fine. We're nobody's perfect.
I am not an example on form. I've lost my. I mean, But hindsight,
yes,
there are a lot of things I shouldn't have said or said in a better way. I mean, lessons.
We're all works in progress.
Yes. I think we need to do that. And the last point, I think if you have a huge social media platform, good for you. Stand up. If you don't have a social media platform, you can still be an influencer with those around you. I think that's, oh no, I am not going to do any, I am not an activist because I don't have 1,000 followers on social media. It's bullshit. You can be an activist if you have 2 friends.
I didn't have 1,000. Yeah. Or, you know.
I mean, you can be an activist however, wherever you are standing in life. And I'm going to say one that I just...
Number 5, single.
Number whatever. There's been this, I think, revenge-like mentality sometimes that if they didn't stand up for me, I'm not going to stand up for them. If the LGBT community didn't stand up for the Jews, I'm never standing up for them. If the feminist women didn't stand up for the Jews, I am not going to stand up for them. Wrong. Let us not forget that Judaism, Jonathan Sacks said that Judaism is the first religion that explained that that the world has a moral purpose. Let us not forget that. Let us not lose sight in this fight of the wonders of Judaism, of the moral guidance it gives, not only for Jews, of Jews for Jews, but of Jews for other minorities, yes, for other social issues, for other things that are right and correct in this world.
100%. I think that's where the end thinking comes. Yes. We don't need to choose between fighting for racial equality, LGBTQ issues, sexism, etc., versus fighting for Jews and against anti-Semitism. We can do both. And if only because there are Jews of every color, shape, form, sexual orientation.
And even if there were no Jews.
Yeah, and even if there were no Jews. Adina, I finish every episode with what I like to call the Jewish lightning round, a series of questions. There's no right or wrong answer, just the first thing that comes to mind. You get one pass and I get to tell you if you get this pass. Adina Chelvinsky, what is one thing people don't know about you?
I'm very scared sometimes.
I didn't know about that, but you.
Very scared.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
We're exactly like every other person in the world. Just Jewish.
Just with pink hair.
Yes.
What is your favorite curse? English, Spanish, Hebrew?
Chingada madre, which means, I don't know, Google it. Chingada madre.
Okay, but can you say it in a, like, you're angry or?
You can say it in, for
no,
me.
No, you say it.
Yeah, chingada madre, I say it in every situation. I wake up every day and I say, puta chingada madre.
I see. It's, okay.
It's my go-to.
I'm going to Google this. When was the last time you cried?
On Thursday,
Guadalajara. If you could have any person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, who would that be?
Winston Churchill.
Interesting. Why?
He was witty. He was very witty. I would love to have I think no leader is perfect. I mean, I think he was really an example of a resistance during a very tough period of, and he was a wonderful speaker. Wonderful speaker. Mm. His words really did make a difference in England in the 40s.
Wow.
Plus, he was not perfect. He was drunk and he was a womanizer and he was a great leader. Not because I am advocating for anyone to be a womanizer or drunk, but I think he's a very,
no,
very
think,
interesting character.
I think this is the whole idea of nuance and complexity.
Yeah.
What's your favorite Jewish holiday?
My favorite Jewish holiday is Hanukkah.
What's your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Yom Kippur, obvious reasons.
When do you feel safest?
When I'm at home.
When do you feel least safe?
When do I feel less safe? When I'm in a new place. That thing about being scared, it connects to that.
What gives you hope?
What gives me hope? Youth. And it sounds, whenever I say, I think of that, I think that makes me sound like my bobe. But
grandmother?
Yeah, like my grandmother in Yiddish. But I do see this sense of awe in certain young people that really does give me hope.
I agree. What is the first thing that comes to mind when you think of the word Jewish civil rights?
A no-brainer. I mean, Jewish civil rights is like, okay, so water is wet. It's like...
It's like every other civil right.
Yes.
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want listeners to donate to this week?
Okay. Can I say two? Chabrat Salah, which I think it's a great organization. And there's an organization in Israel called Natal that focuses on trauma and PTSD for this, right now for the survivors of October 7th, which in Israel, everyone is a survivor of October 7th in some way. So
Chevrat Salah and Natal, N-A-T-A-L. Adina, where can people find you?
Social media.
What's your...
Instagram or Twitter, at Adina Chel, A-D-I-N-A-C-H-E-L.
What's next for Adina?
What's next for Adina? Enjoying New York for the rest of the day. And I don't know. It's this, I don't know. Today I woke up committed, a committed Jew. I don't know how I'm going to wake up tomorrow.
More committed.
Yeah, probably.
Thank you so much for taking the time, for flying here to come and do this in person. I have so many more questions, but we need to keep something for next seasons, yes, which I'll have you. And if people speak Spanish, where can they find your podcast?
La Burra Arisca is on Spotify and at Burras Ariscas in every social media platform.
If there's ever a reason to learn Spanish, it's to listen to your podcast.
Of course.
Thank you so much for being here. And I'm so glad to say this. Here I am, Adina Chelminsky.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."